You and Me and BPD. Season 3, Episode 12. Conceptualizing Self-Harm. Hi. So, today, we're going to be talking about self-harm. And I put a poll on my Instagram stories where I typically ask people what episode they want. And this was the episode that won. And it's obviously going to be a little bit of a triggering episode, especially if you are somebody who still engages with these types of activities and coping techniques. So if you are not feeling like you are capable of having this kind of honest conversation, then I would suggest you skip this episode. Just full on. You don't need to listen to it. I don't want to trigger you. I don't want you to fall into some, you know, spiral. So just be aware that this is going to be more of a triggering episode. We have Jay here for this episode as well.
Hello.
So Jay has been on the podcast a couple of times. For those who don't know, Jay is my husband. We've been married now for 6 years. And we're going to be talking about this because it's something that we both experienced. And also, self-harming is very prevalent in the BPD community. According to a 2014 study, there was a statistic that was found, which is 65 to 80% of people with BPD experience some form of self-harm. That, just to get that out of the way, that means that self-harm is not exclusive to people with BPD. There are many different people who have depression, anxiety, PTSD, who struggle with dissociation and memories of abuse that might choose to self-harm. So this is a conversation that can apply to many different people. But obviously there are a lot of people within the BPD community who do experience self-harm tendencies and who do report non-suicidal self-injury. So it is a tough conversation to have, but we're going to be talking from kind of our own perspectives and our own experiences. So a lot of these statistics I'm going to be talking about are coming from the Self-Harm Toolkit, and that's linked below, and I'm also going to put it on my Instagram stories if you want to look into that. So according to them, most people begin self-harming between the ages of 12 and 15 years old, and about 15 to 24% of youth have acknowledged that they have self-harmed in the past. And usually self-harming ends when someone reaches adulthood, although 5% of the adult population also will engage in self-harming tendencies. So kind of just, Jay, for you, do you remember, like, how old you were when you first self-harmed? Like, do you remember what the kind of circumstances were for you, or?
I probably would have been around 14, I think. I don't remember specifically what would have been the very first time, but just remembering what I was like back then, it was most likely during some kind of state of high emotion as opposed to like numbness.
Yeah.
Most likely I was upset with my mom, or like a girl didn't return my feelings or something.
Yeah.
And you know, rather than getting angry at other people, I you know, take it out on myself instead. Yeah.
I mean, that's super common. That's also kind of my experiences. So I believe I was 15, and I still remember it was like the day before a dance, and I was really upset, and I remember I was crying at like 2 a.m. and I was just filled with emotions, and I didn't know what to do about all those emotions. I was one of those kids that like got really angry and really emotional really quickly, and I just remember feeling overwhelmed. And I actually remember I had a friend who self-harmed at the time, and when I asked her about it, she was like, oh, it helps me when I'm, like, feeling mad and angry. And I was like, it was 2 a.m. I was by myself. So I was like, oh, maybe this will help me too. And yeah, I think it was a mixture of just not knowing how to handle myself. And also, I was very impressionable. So if somebody said, like, this is what I did and this is what helped me, then I was like, oh, okay, I should try that too. And I'm very much still like that, I think, to this day. Just, I do it in more kind of, I would hope, positive ways. But yeah, a lot of children, like adolescents, engage in self-harming tendencies. And some of the most common methods, this is still, again, from the self-harm toolkit, is 75% of respondents, they engage in cutting, which is, you know, cutting your wrist or your leg or some other part of your body with, normally I think it's razor blades that people get. That's what I remember using. There's also 30% of people will engage in self-hitting. So this could be hitting themselves with something or hitting their head against the wall or, you know, yeah, essentially that. Or 28% of people engage in burning. So I knew someone who would use a lighter and would make it really, really hot and then burn her leg with it.
Yeah, that was called Smiley. Where I went to.
Oh, really?
High school. Yeah,
they had like a specific name.
Smiley face.
Interesting.
Like a scar.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think that I'm not sure about that razor blade thing being common because most, maybe it's just because I grew up in a poor area, but yeah. Like kids don't really have access as easily to razor blades. People I knew use like the compass from their math kit or just like a sharpened pencil or.
I remember going to the dollar store and buying, there's like razor blades you can use for your eyebrows to like shave your eyebrows off. And they were just openly available. And I just walked in and bought some and no one asked me anything. Like they were just like, here you go at like 14.
Yeah, maybe that's like growing up in the city. Yeah. The country difference because I hadn't seen a dollar store till I moved out.
Yeah. But these are not the only type of self-harm that people engage in. There's also restricting food or compulsively exercising, which can eventually lead to an eating disorder, which is slightly different. It's still a form of self-harm, but it might be because of other mental illnesses, and eating disorders are themselves a type of mental illness. Some people will also pick at their skin or will pull out their hair. I don't know if you knew anyone like that, but I knew people who would like scratch themselves so that they would bleed and stuff. And that was pretty intense because you would see them kind of scratching really hard at their arms or their legs. One of the misconceptions, which is why I wanted Jay to be a part of this podcast, is there's kind of this social narrative that self-harming is a like female thing, and there are statistics that say that females in between the ages of 14 to 16 are 5 times more likely to be hospitalized because of their self-harming, and that females are more likely to report their self-harming or try to get professional help for their self-harming. But one of the things out there is that there are still a lot of young boys and males who engage in self-harming tendencies. And I think that that is an often stigmatized, even within self-harm, it's further stigmatized when you're a guy who engages in it. Like I knew a lot of girls who did a lot of things to self-harm, but I think it wasn't until I met you that I actually, like, I was able to have a conversation with a guy who admitted that they did engage in this type of...
Yeah, I think I knew one other guy, but mostly girls. I think I've always been a male who's been more expressive with my emotional side compared to other people in middle school and high school. I was writing depressing poetry on DeviantArt as well at the same time as all this.
Yeah, so one of the things that I think people struggle to understand is, why do people self-harm, right? And there are many different reasons, obviously. As I mentioned before, some people self-harm because they have gone through intense trauma, or because they feel unsafe in their body because they went through some type of physical or sexual abuse. People self-harm because they might be experiencing depression and they don't really know how to talk about it. Some people self-harm, well, a lot of people with BPD say that they self-harm because they feel so many emotions, or they feel nothing at all. And self-harming, the act of self-harming, is a way to feel something. And that, I think for myself, I can recognize that self-harming for me was a way to navigate my emotional side without having the capacity to actually speak about it. Like, I don't know about you, but I didn't have a lot of people I talked to about my mental health when I was younger. Like, I felt very isolated. I felt very alone. I felt very much like there was nobody who could understand what was going on with me. And when I started to feel kind of all of these feelings all at once, for me, self-harming was a way to feel something other than emotional pain. Like, to go into a physical aspect and to be kind of grounded in my body, to know, okay, I don't know what's going on in my head right now. I'm feeling lots of different things, but I feel better because I can feel this physical manifestation of my pain. Like, I'm able to feel the stinging of, I was engaging in cutting activity on my arms mainly. And so I was able to feel the sting of the actual cut being made. And for me, it helped me to feel more grounded in my body. And it also, a lot of people say that it helps them to feel a sense of control over themselves. So especially if they feel like they don't have very much control in the rest of their life, like if they're in a toxic situation, or if they're just having a lot of problems with their parents and their friends and their school and stuff, it helps them to feel like they are more kind of aware of what's happening to them, and they have some semblance of, this is something I can do for myself. I don't know if it was like that for you.
No. I'd say not at all. Nothing to do with the physicality or anything to do with really my body. And I mean, I hate pain. For me, it ultimately boils down to attention. To wanting essentially people to feel bad for me. And that the idea that if people are paying attention to me and feeling bad for me, I would feel a kind of a sympathy or like a emotional connectedness to that person that I guess I was not finding elsewhere.
So did you want somebody to like care about you, essentially? It was like a, look, I want somebody to care about me so much that I am willing to hurt myself in the hopes that someone will care.
One, I would say it's 50% that, and the other 50% being that I am really bad at handling like argument and confrontation.
Okay.
And I figure if someone would potentially be upset with me, and they see that I am, essentially, you don't have to be upset with me because I'm already so upset with myself. Like, this is already taken care of. You don't have to, you don't have to bully me. I'm bullying me.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that is also very common when it comes to self-harm, is people who Especially if people have experienced trauma, they do it as a kind of way of being like, I feel like I'm a horrible person, and I feel like my body's a horrible body, so I may as well make it look horrible, or I may as well do something to myself that shows that I'm a horrible person, right? And once again, that stems from the fact that people, when they experience things, especially young people, and they don't know how to talk about it, and they don't know how to start a conversation, one of the kind of first places that you turn is internally, is like, I don't want to hurt other people, I don't want to cause other people stress, so I'm going to take all my emotions and I'm going to turn it on myself, and I'm going to do something to help myself, even if it is a destructive thing that is generally not something that we would do. Because I remember, like, I self-harmed for about a year, and I remember towards the end of it, I got into a really big argument with my mom, and I showed my mom, like, my cuts, and she was like, oh my god, why would you do something like that? Like, that's crazy, blah, 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 like, yelling at me. And it was like, finally, there's someone who, like, cares, right? Really twistedly, is, like, yelling at me, but at the same time is also like, oh, finally someone cares, because I had friends who knew and didn't say anything or didn't do anything or, like, didn't talk to me about anything.
At least you got some kind of reaction.
I know.
I feel like everyone I showed, because I definitely didn't hide it.
So you, like, actively showed people?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Wow. All the time.
Oh, my God. Okay. I didn't know that, but...
Yeah, my mom, my friends...
God damn.
Yeah, but pretty much no reaction from...
no one said anything to you? Anybody.
No. No. Yeah, and so I just kept doing it more and more dramatically for a couple years, I guess, until eventually giving up that that route.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't working.
Yeah. That's so hard, because it's like you... At that point, you're like, I'm reaching out for help. I'm showing you I need help. I'm showing you that physically I can't handle myself. And yet no one's, like, stepping in.
Well, again, the emotionally mature thing that, you know, I did not have the capacity for as a teenager would be to actually ask for help. If someone had approached me at the time and said, do you need help? I'd say, no, go away.
Yeah.
This was, I guess, my option, because I was too, you know, stubborn or proud to actually directly ask for help.
Yeah. It's a really hard thing to kind of understand from an outside perspective, because I can completely relate to that. I completely understand that, like, you don't want to ask for help. And if somebody says that you need help, I feel like that would have been, if somebody would have said, like, you need help, I feel like I might have, because I was a teenager, I might have worn it with, like, a badge of honor or something and been like, people say I need help, but, like, really, I did need help. I needed a lot of freaking help, and I didn't get it. And it was really hard to kind of navigate. I think that's why I stopped eventually, is because I was just like, this isn't doing anything for me anymore. Like, no one's realizing that I need the help that I need. And at that point, I just didn't want to do it. Like, I just kind of got bored, because I get bored really quickly. I was just kind of like, I don't want to do this anymore. But that's why I think a lot of, when people get to adulthood, right, they turn to other things, other forms of self-harming, like maybe they become workaholics, or maybe they start not treating themselves very well by not eating properly, or by...
She laughed because I had a guilty look when she said become workaholic.
Well, it's another form of working yourself so hard that you don't need to deal with your mental health, right? Mm-hmm. You kind of push everything into work and everything into... I'm gonna be this person, I'm gonna, like, and then it leads to burnout, right? Like, essentially burnout is from not taking care of yourself enough. Sorry, I digress. One of the important things to think about in terms of self-harm is that, as I hope you've seen, there are many reasons why people self-harm. And obviously, we can't tell you how to necessarily get out of it, because I don't know what made you stop. Like, why do you not engage in self-harm anymore?
Well, I don't know if I would say I don't engage in it. I mean, I don't cut anymore, but I think, you know, I have transitioned, as many people do, to the more socially acceptable adult, you know, self-harm light, where, like you mentioned, working yourself so hard you don't have to think about your emotions. Doing things like, I know sometimes when we argue, my option is what I resort to instead of being upset at you is to, like, you know, deny myself, you know, eating dinner or something like that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's still the same sort of, like, you don't have to be upset with me, I'm upset with myself.
Yeah.
I feel like I have grown out of the specifically cry for help, attention seeking kind of self-harm.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's so common to see, someone, banging their own head in frustration after their boss was just shouting at them, and they sat there and took it, and the boss walks away and they bang their head on something. And, like, that could be, like, a funny scene in a movie or something. But, I mean, it's still the same self-harm.
No, it definitely is. And I think that that's kind of where a lot of the time people... Obviously, we can't get into all of the technical details around, like, how can you help stop self-harm? Because that really depends on the individual person. Some people need therapy, and some people do great with just going to therapy every week. Some people need more intense forms of therapy, like inpatient therapeutic services. And I've known several people who have gone to inpatient facilities because they needed more intense ways of dealing with their mental health and learning how to deal with it. And when it comes to, since this podcast is mainly about BPD, when it comes to BPD, there's still a lot of people who engage in restrictive dieting or who engage in, you know, pushing themselves to the extreme with working out or working, or, like, there's various ways, like Jay was saying, that it's almost like when you get to being an adult, people are more prone to kind of overlook what self-harming tendencies you have if it seems like you're a successful person on the outside, right? But ultimately, there are still a lot of young people who self-harm, and there are still a lot of adults. It's only 5% of the general population, but within the BPD community, it's pretty high of people who engage in self-harming tendencies.
The people who admit to it.
Yeah, like, that's a whole other perspective. And one of the things is professional help, getting professional help should never be a stigma, and it should not be something that you are afraid of. I get lots of messages from people who say that they're afraid of going to a therapist, they're afraid of admitting that they need, like, actual therapeutic help, and, like, that's not a shameful thing. It's not shameful to need help and to not know how to navigate the world of your mental health, because obviously if you've been engaging in these type of activities and these type of tendencies since you were a teenager, for some people it's been most of their, like, cognitive life that they have been engaging in some form of self-harm. So if you are one of these people, please understand that it is not, I think I've said this so many times in this podcast, it is not shameful to reach out to people, to have a safety plan in place, and depending on what type of self-harm you engage in, there's going to be different types of safety plans, but obviously it would be best to work with a therapist, to work with somebody who can actually help you step by step with recognizing your triggers, recognizing why you do things. Like, as a teenager, it's really hard because you don't know. right? Like, I can think about why I self-harmed before, but there was so much going on at the time that I don't even think I can fully understand why I did it.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if it seems difficult to find the right kind of support, that is not your fault.
No.
Your feeling that it's hard, it's, you know, society's fault. It is the, you know, nothing makes it easy. And,
I mean, there's statistics that say that people who are gender diverse, people who come from marginalized communities, are more likely to engage in self-harm because they literally can't see any way of helping themselves. They can't have the conversations that need to happen in order for them to actually get whatever professional help they might need. Like, that is a very real statistic, and that is a very real way that self-harm continues to happen. But one of the best things, and also going to be the hardest things, is to find people that will listen to you and people that will be empathetic. Like, I think both of our parents dealt with it in terms of just, oh my gosh, I'm sure if you talked to your mom about it, your mom would have been like, I don't know what to do here, so I'm gonna do nothing. Because I feel like that was my mom's perspective of just, I don't know how to help Steph, so I may as well do nothing at all and just hope that it goes away on its own. And fundamentally, that is probably not the best way. I think, as a parent now, I don't think that's what I would do if our son came and said, I'm self-harming. Yeah, I wouldn't just be like...
We would be all over.
Yeah, that. Like, I think one of the things through going through this experience is recognizing that it does happen to a lot of people, and that ultimately the best kind of way to handle it is with compassion and understanding and empathy, and recognizing that there are a lot of young people who are engaging in this type of coping mechanism, because that's all it really is. It's just a way to cope with their emotional turmoil inside of them. One thing kind of before we wrap up is just, I just want to mention that the majority of those who self-injure, who self-harm, do not have suicidal thoughts. There are a lot of people who they begin self-harming, and then when they don't get the attention that they're seeking, or they don't get the help that they're seeking, they might turn to having suicidal tendencies. They might think, no one cares about me, so I may as well, like, go a step further.
Yeah.
But ultimately, self-harm does not equal suicidal ideation. A lot of people who self-harm are not actively suicidal, and I think it's important. I made a podcast episode about this before, about suicide ideation. I think it's important to understand that self-harm does not equal suicidal tendencies or active suicidality. There can be an overlap, and there's some people who self-harm to the point that it looks like it's a suicide attempt, but it's not always the same thing. And for some people, like, I know for you, I'm sure there was a point where it overlapped, where your self-harm started to become suicide ideation, but it wasn't for me. I think when I was younger, it wasn't. That was not something that I actively...
Yeah, no, it was a crossover for me as well. Essentially, that self-harm, I wanted everyone to know, and then as soon as I started feeling like I actually wanted to end my life, I didn't want anyone to know that.
Yeah, so, like, there's a point where I think it switches, and that does not mean, like, just the main thing is, if you are somebody who knows somebody who self-harms and you're trying to figure out, do they want to kill themselves, like, do I need to have this kind of suicide conversation with them, that's a completely other conversation to have besides self-harm. I think that when we talk about these types of things, we need to be very clear on the fact that not everybody who does self-harm wants to commit suicide. Like, you might want to at certain points in time, but it is not a direct correlation. And also, as I mentioned before, self-harming is not exclusive to BPD. You don't have BPD. We don't know what you have, because you won't go see a therapist. But I'm pretty sure you don't have BPD, and yet you still experienced it. right? And yeah, a lot of young people experience it for many different reasons. Yeah. Obviously, this is a really tough conversation, and we're just kind of skimming the surface, but this is a conversation that needs to happen because it's very prevalent among young people, and it's very prevalent among people with BPD. And obviously, I want you to be safe. So if you are feeling like you're being triggered by this, please look at the self-harm toolkit. I put it in the description of this podcast episode. And please understand that your mental health journey is going to be your own thing. And you need to find ways to cope with your mental health in ways that keep you safe and does not harm you. Because I want you to be here. And I want you to continue to live this life and get to experience all of the joy that waits in the future. Because I think if somebody would have told me when I was a teenager that I would be so open to talking about my self-harm, I would have like laughed in their face and been like, no, I'm never gonna tell anyone. But here I am. I have these conversations because it's important to talk about these things and to not hide them and to not be ashamed of the past. I think almost everyone I know has self-harmed at some point in time. Like, it's a thing that a lot of people don't want to admit. But I think it's really important to continue to have these conversations.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
What would you, your current self...
My current self.
Tell high school Steph. What kind of conversation would you have with them on the topic of...
Of self-harming?
Yeah.
I probably would have said something along the lines of just you are feeling a lot of feelings, and feelings are not bad, and it's very hard to feel those feelings, and you need to be an advocate for yourself, because ultimately I was waiting for somebody to notice that there is something going on with me. I was waiting for somebody to say something. I was like, and the thing was, is that I went to my guidance counselor. I like eventually showed my mom, like I did the steps to get somebody to notice that I was struggling, and no one did. Right. And I think I would go to like high school stuff and just be like, I know it's hard, but like you need to advocate for yourself, because I wanted help from like one of my, like I knew I wanted help, but no one was willing to give it to me. And also I think to fundamentally don't take your boyfriend so seriously. I think that's what I would say fundamentally, because mine came from a lot of emotional dissonance in terms of my relationships to people.
Yeah.
And to be like, look, they're not worth it. That dude at 15, not freaking worth it. Like, that guy who's making you feel that way, tell him to fuck off. Like, he's not worth it at all. And you don't deserve this. You don't deserve anything that's going on in your life right now. Like, it is hard. Being a teenager is fucking hard. It is not easy. But you have to do it. Like, you have to be here. And I think that's kind of what I would tell Steph now, even, is life is hard and it's not easy and you have to do it. Like, sometimes it sucks.
And don't get so hung up on boys.
Don't get so hung up on boys, right? Like, just freaking recognize that your boyfriend at 15 is not the end of the world. Like, come on, Steph, right? Like, legit. Jay, thank you for being here. As always, you're always here, but thank you for being here. Me and Jay are going to record a podcast later on about marijuana use and mental health, because that's something else that we can talk about. But as always, if you have any comments, questions, want to follow up with anything in this episode, you can feel free to reach out to me on my Instagram at journey, JOURNEY, yes, .bound, BOUND. And I would be happy to give you resources, to give you helpline numbers, to talk with you, or just, you know, have a conversation. I'm always willing to do that. Yeah.
Join us next week for more happy, uplifting topics like this one.
It is hard to talk about, but we have to. You know, we have to have these conversations because ultimately, who else can have these conversations if not two 30-year-olds who are pretty mentally unstable?
Pretty, comma, mentally unstable.
Yes. All right. I am sending you so much love, and I hope that you take something away from this episode. Bye.
Bye.